Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, February 25th, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember, our shows are available 24/7 on prn.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today, you will hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 22 of the hour. And we got another great show for you today that will include, does your baby need a baby wash?
And does diet soda increase the risk for type 2 diabetes?
And what about omega-3 fatty acids? Do they really protect against breast cancer?
And do epidural steroid injections make you worse in the long term?
And what's a practical way to improve nutrition in our school lunches? You know, Vicki, one of my pet peeves is how the pharmaceutical industry is controlling so much of America's business and how it controls our health care. And it's outrageous that they get away with what they do.
I know you talk a lot about this in your book, A Return to Healing.
I know. I wrote a whole chapter called The Karma of Big Pharma.
Which is a very appropriate title.
Well, it really is. And you know, outrage, though, isn't enough. We need to do something more about how we're going to stop this process and how we're going to get back to the democracy we had a couple of hundred years ago, where we actually were empowered to make decisions about how we wanted our government to work and how we wanted corporations to work and how we could be responsible at doing things that we wanted to change. And that's leaving us. This whole business about what Big Pharma can do because of its relationship with the FDA, with the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, and innumerable big organizations, even the World Health Organization, is deeply ingrained or engrossed in the business of the pharmaceutical industry.
One way to put it is that they're often in bed with each other.
Well, there's no doubt about that, and it doesn't seem to stop. You know, week after week, we keep talking about one problem that comes up and another one. You know, we talked about the Vioxx story to start with, you know, about 8 years ago or 10 years ago. And now we're back in the news with other drugs, with the companies doing the same thing.
Well, let's talk about Johnson & Johnson, why they're in the news now.
Oh, for sure. And you have to look back a little bit at their CEO, William Weldon, at least back a few years ago. When Johnson & Johnson was having kind of a bad run, where their products their products were probably contaminated with bacteria, and they had metal fragments in them, and they took Tylenol and Benadryl and Motrin off the market, and the company tried to buy up all the products from the pharmacies that they had delivered them. And
Without telling anybody. Yeah, they were supposed to report that to the FDA.
Right. So they come out and they apologize and say, yeah, we were bad. We won't do it again. But don't punish us too much now because we've learned our lesson.
Well, the reason they're sorry was just because they got caught, not because of what they did.
Well, that's right. And, you know, when the FDA went through and they looked at their facilities, they had over 20 serious manufacturing and quality violations. I mean, it's incredible that a company like that could get away with that. And it's more incredible that we could forgive them and say, we'll give them a chance.
Well, now their baby wash, you know, is full of toxins, and they don't seem to have any conscience about it. And they're promoting themselves as, you know, everybody thinks of Johnson & Johnson as, oh, the sweet baby smell and the no more tears and all that kind of thing. But what did this article actually say?
Well, it's looking at something called a baby wash, okay? So they've got this baby wash that they're putting out there that's called Johnson's Baby Toe-to-Toe Wash. And they did a little study comparing it with plain water. Now, you have to keep in mind that this study was done at the University of Manchester in England. And their organization called the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence is called NICE, actually, for short. States that people should not be putting anything on a baby's skin during the first 6 weeks after birth, because the baby's skin is very permeable, and whatever in it will get into the baby's body, and it's not healthy for it.
Well, you know, I was on the Skin Deep database by the Environmental Working Group that's supported by the SafeCosmetics.org, and they listed Johnson & Johnson's baby wash products, because there's different ones, mm-hmm, on a 4 to 8 hazards. And the hazard level is from 1 to 10, 10 being the worst hazard. So They started out at 4, but I wanted to just mention some of the safe choices that were 0. Mm-hmm. And there was some. There's one called Enkido and Delicioso, Caring and Conscious Castile Soap, Bear Organics, Badger, Baby Organic Coconut Foam, Baby Hugo, Adorable Baby, and so forth.
You can go to a lot of them.
You can go to skindeep.org and put that in there for baby wash, and those will come up. So those aren't going to have any toxic levels. We have to really be careful about some of these products that go on the skin, because with this Johnson & Johnson, the ingredients, I was reading the ingredients and I was horrified. Many of the ingredients are linked to cancer and fertility problems and skin problems. I mean, that's the least that you want to do to your newborn baby. And I think people need to keep in mind that Johnson & Johnson, other companies that they own, so that people are just aware of things like Neutrogena, Aveeno, Lubriderm, Clean and Clear, and so forth.
There's and none of these are very high on the safety list, are they?
But one of the things that they're trying to make a big deal out of is that they're saying that Johnson & Johnson says that by 2015 that they're going to remove the formaldehyde releasers and the triclosan and the 1,4-dioxane. But it doesn't say that they really are. It just says that they have an intention to do it.
Well, if they're really serious about doing the right thing, they would just do that. It wouldn't be on their to-do list. It would be on their have-done list.
Exactly. So one of the things that people might not be aware of is that the formaldehyde and the 1,4-dioxane are actually things that are made in the chemical processing.
So they don't put them in, but they're manufactured by the process.
Yes, they're byproducts that are formed when the preservatives react to one another. And so they're considered contaminants, not ingredients, so they don't have to disclose them on the labels. And there's a widespread use of these ingredients. So what parents can do really is, like you were saying, they don't even need to use products. I guess they could just use water, but you can use fewer products and products that have fewer ingredients.
Well, you could use water, too. I'd have to take a case I stand for that water would be the best one. It may not smell the best when you're done, but it's one that's natural.
And well, that's another thing. We don't want products that have
fragrance.
Smell, that have fragrance.
Right. So what's wrong with
plain old
water?
But everybody loves the smell of Johnson & Johnson. It smells like a baby. Yeah, right. And, you know, there's a company now called Dolce & Gabbana that has perfume for babies. Can you believe that? It's so bad.
Well, it gets right across the baby's skin during the first several weeks after birth, and that's why the organization said that they didn't think they should use anything on kids for the first 6 weeks after birth. And I agree with that. I mean, water is perfect to do the job. And the thing that got me the most when we look at Johnson & Johnson's head-to-toe baby wash is at the very bottom, it says safety tip. Keep out of the reach of children. It's like, hello?
That's like the toothpaste that says a pea-sized amount will call the poison control.
If they're
and what child
right.
isn't going to swallow some of the toothpaste? But anyway, I just want people to be aware, too, that there's no formaldehyde in the Johnson & Johnson baby products in Japan.
Is that right?
Yeah. They take it out for them because they demand it. And also,
so that tells you they know about it. It's not like it's some mystery. They can't plead that they didn't know what's going on.
Yeah, well, standards in the U.S. are way behind the standards in Europe or Japan. So maybe if you want to have a baby, move to Europe or Japan.
All right. Well, that would be something. You know, one of the other things that came up as we're looking at this whole topic is, what does this article really say? They're studying what? They're talking about skin water loss. Now, water loss is an important thing in the skin. I would agree with that. But isn't it convenient to talk about water loss when it's not really even much of an issue? And it distracts you from what? All the other things that are in there that aren't studied in this article. And I even communicated with the authors of this article, and they didn't really respond to what did they think about the chemicals were in it. They were really just saying, well, we did a study that just looked at water loss. And my position on that is that's really not a very honest thing to do, because what you're doing is distracting the public from the real issues that are there. It's not so much about water loss, even though that's an issue. And just because there's no water loss, I mean, doesn't mean that it's great. Think about people who have edema. They have more water in their skin and more water in their subcutaneous tissues. That's not a good thing.
Years ago, when I was a student nurse, I worked in the premature, in the nursery with the babies and so forth. Mm-hmm. And We washed all the babies with Physahex at the time.
Oh, my gosh. It'd be the worst thing I could think of.
So what's that main ingredient that's in Physahex?
Hexachlorophene.
Hexachlorophene.
That's right.
Because they were so afraid of germs. Well, what happened is that these tiny little babies' skin got so dry that it would crack. Mm-hmm. And then it was open to be more receptive to getting germs and to get infections. So after several years, they quit doing that.
Well, let's keep in mind that germs aren't bad. Actually, germs are good, and we have a normal flora on our skin that's important. And when you use something like triclosan or hexachlorophene or one of the other toxic chemicals that kills most microbes, what's left is an open terrain where microbes can come back, and a lot of the time they're the ones that are toxic, and that's why you can get skin infections from that. So the best thing to do on a baby's skin or anybody's skin is to wash it with water. Because then you're just taking off the excess.
But if you want to use a little soap or something on their bottoms, because, you know, they kind of like you don't want to just rinse that off.
Well, you can. I mean.
Well, I think I'd rather use something a little bit more. You could probably even just use an oil. But there's Dr. Bonner's Castile soap, too, and other brands that you would have to look into that are just mild olive oil based. And some of them have other vegetable oils with the olive oil,
right,
like
so
coconut or jojoba or palm oil, but they don't have artificial foaming agents and things like that.
So if you're going to use something, which I personally don't recommend, then those would be products that would be far less dangerous than the others.
Yeah, because they don't contain the petrochemicals. They don't have the antibacterial agents like the triclosan and so forth.
Right.
So that's what we want to avoid.
Well, I think that's true. And if we do, our babies are going to be a lot healthier. But we've got to keep in mind that as soon as we put something on a baby's skin that's not normally there, we're changing the terrain. And when you change the biochemical terrain, you change what microbes can live there. And when you change what microbes that live there, you're playing Russian roulette.
But if you don't do something to change the microbes under your armpit, you're going to have
BO. Well, okay, so use baking soda. Okay, so, I mean, we can carry this argument or this discussion to an extreme, but I'm just saying that the best thing for babies is water. I mean, that's what's the normal thing there, and it doesn't change the microflora, and it's a good thing. Now, there's another aspect of this that really bugs me big time. I'm going to say shame on the Journal of Obstetric, Gynecological, and Neonatal Nursing Journal. They published this crazy article. Why would they do that? Did they get something in return for it? I mean, was there an agreement that was made? Did the company, J&J, give them some kind of reimbursement?
It's pretty obvious something happened here.
Well, we know who did the study. Okay, J&J paid for it because I asked for that information, and they told me J&J paid for it. And that's fine. That's all okay. But why would a reputable journal put an article in that has almost nothing to do with whether or not a product is a good one? It looks at one narrow aspect.
It's like an ad.
It is like it.
And it's absolutely crazy because they even list the ingredients. If you look up the ingredients, you don't want to put that on your baby.
Yeah, well, that's right. And so what we have here is a collusion, a system of collusion that involves J&J, the researchers most likely, the FDA, the Journal of Obstetric, Gynecological, and Neonatal Nursing, and who knows who else is involved in that. And it's dishonest to give people the idea that this is a great product because it doesn't change or maybe it slightly increases the amount of water that's in skin.
Well, the other thing is that they have this No More Tears formula.
Uh-huh.
And it used to be that the reason the baby didn't get any tears and it didn't burn their eyes is because they had an anesthetic in it.
Yeah, great.
So after a while, people found out and they complained about it. And so then they replaced it with another chemical that's also toxic. And if you think about it, when you pick up a bottle of Johnson & Johnson, like the baby shampoo, for example, and you try to read the ingredients,
oh,
you have to look through the bottle.
You have to read it.
It's a plastic bottle, and the color of the shampoo is yellow, last I checked.
Right.
And there's no way you can read what's on those ingredients, and that's suspicious right there. I mean, why wouldn't they just have it on the back of the bottle?
That's
where you could see it instead of through the back of the bottle.
Well, look at the magic of our advertising industry. They are absolutely brilliant. They've convinced us that we need products like this for our baby's bottom or baby's skin, that we need sleeping pills, that we need pills for ADD, that we need pills for all kinds of things that are lifestyle-oriented issues that we don't want to address ourselves, that they'll help us to get involved with. But every time we put something in or on our body that's not natural, we're putting in a foreign chemical that always has some kind of negative effect when we look deeply enough into the biochemistry and physiology of our body.
I think people need to be aware that the cosmetics industry is self-regulating, and it can do whatever it wants. And the cosmetic companies can add nearly any ingredient to cosmetics without government-regulated safety testing.
Right. Not that would make it safe, because we've already got an FDA. And when you look at the pharmaceutical industry's relationship with it, there's a revolving door between the two places. There are probably 20 to 25% of people who are voting on FDA issues are from where? From the pharmaceutical industry. And if you think they're going to be neutral in that and just come up with honest answers, you're very mistaken. Can you imagine being somebody who works for a pharmaceutical company and being on an FDA panel and coming back on Monday after you voted no and said this product shouldn't be passed? You're not going to be in that company very long. That's what happens, and that's where the conflicts of interest come up. And we all kind of live with that and kind of expect it to be normal. We expect to be convinced by the ads that we see and by what the pharmaceutical companies say or what these other companies that make products, skincare products and cosmetics and household cleaning agents. They're all things that we shouldn't be just taking for granted that they're being honest about, because the bulk of the time they're not.
We have a lot more information on this topic, too, on our website,
drsaputo.com,
and Vicky's Corner.
Yeah, you can go there. And it's all, this is an all-free website, by the way, and it's got 2,300 audios and videos on it that Vicky and I have personally made, and 33 health assessments that are free that take about 3 or 4 minutes to take. And then they will guide you to solutions to your healthcare issues from an integrative point of view. So it's our contribution, our gift to you. We don't make any money off the site. It's just a public service. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicky. It's time for Vicky's first 2020 tip on why should you avoid low-fat cheese and milk? That's a surprise. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, does diet soda increase the risk for type 2 diabetes?
Do you reach for the low-fat cheese and milk? Well, you might want to think again. While dietitians and others recommend low and no-fat varieties, more experts are starting to realize why full-fat milk and cheese and dairy as a whole should be chosen.
Now, it's about time. This has been a pet peeve of mine for a long time.
If you want to lose weight and be healthy, you need to skip the skim and reach for the full-fat varieties instead, especially dairy. So you might ask, how can this be? I mean, this is pretty surprising. We've definitely been brainwashed to think that we should go for the non-fat and the low-fat milk. But about half of the fat in full-fat dairy products is saturated. And up until recently, it was a villain in a lot of food myths. And this fat fallacy was promoted in the 50s. And as a result, 51% of today's average American is trying to consume less fat. Now, you've probably heard us say that not all fats are created alike. And so we now know to avoid the trans fats and refined polyunsaturated fats in the vegetable oils like the corn and the soy and the sunflower and the canola oil. But moderate saturated fats like coconut oil and grass-fed animals, that's mounting. And coconut oil and lard, they got their bad rap from Crisco and the vegetable oil campaigns of the 70s. And an analysis published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition concluded that there's no significant evidence for saturated fat being associated with an increased risk of coronary heart disease or cardiovascular disease.
Boy, you just said a big one there.
I know, and this is just really difficult, I think, for people to grasp. Because it's very, very hard to change a mindset.
Well, people think that cholesterol is bad for them, too. And the fact is that the cholesterol is made from saturated fat. And without cholesterol, you'd be dead because you need it to make an awful lot of things in our body, like the vitamin D and most of the hormones that are in our body, as well as cell membranes and neurotransmitters. I mean, this is time that we wake up to this. This is a good point, Vicki.
Well, besides saturated fat... the dairy fat also contains oleic acid. That's the stuff that makes olive oil so healthy, mm-hmm. along with conjugated linoleic acid, the CLA. Mm-hmm. And that helps with weight loss, and it quiets bowel disease, and it converts fat into muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the most healthy kind of dairy is the raw kind from grass-fed cows, goats, or sheep.
Where do you get that?
That have not been pasteurized, and now they don't allow it. They've taken it off the shelves.
So I guess something that's good for you, we can't eat that.
So we have to have our own farm.
Get your own cow.
Learn how to milk a cow or a goat or a sheep.
That's right.
But pasteurized full-fat milk from the grass-fed animals is still healthier than the other kind.
Oh, for sure.
Than the further processed low or non-fat varieties. And saturated fats are known to be, get this now, this is important, antiviral, antifungal, and anti-plaque.
Mm-hmm.
But the benefits of these fats don't end there, because they can help you to lose weight, because they slow down digestion and you consume more calories, and so you can go longer without eating again. They encourage heart health. They did a 16-year study in Australia on adults, and they found that those that ate full-fat dairy were less likely to get cardiovascular disease.
That's ironic, isn't it?
It lowers the risk of cancer, and especially bowel cancer. They may even help with diabetes because of the palmitic acid that protects against the insulin resistance. They aid in vitamin absorption, like with vitamin A and D and E and K. In other words, the fat-soluble vitamins.
That's right.
And if you're looking to lose weight, keep the grass-fed fats, olive oil, coconut oil, and ditch the low-fat salad dressing and the non-fat yogurts.
Really good point there, Vicki. And this is so contrary to what the American public thinks. You know, when Dean Ornish, bless his heart, I mean, he's done some really wonderful research, and he's certainly one of my heroes. I think he's a little off the mark on this one. Even though you can do a lot of different kinds of diets and still do well from the point of view of protecting against heart attacks and strokes. But the low-fat part, I think, is one way to do it that's not so healthy. And I love this tip that you gave, because
it's funny, because I was in one of the health food stores the other day, and I was reaching for the milk, and I really wanted to go for the low-fat, but it was like, no. So I grabbed the whole milk. Uh-huh. And this lady next to me was reaching for the non-fat, I was tempted to say, but I didn't.
Yeah, well, that was probably wise.
She wouldn't have believed. She would have thought I was nuts.
Exactly.
So, are diet sodas a good idea for diabetes? Oh. Well, the answer is going to surprise you, because not only do diet sodas increase the risk for diabetes, but diet soda drinkers have a higher risk of diabetes than those who drink regular sugar-filled sodas. So, how can this be?
Yeah, well, see, that's what the American Dietetic Association says. You can have a certain amount, you can have diet drinks. They actually support that. And I would agree that sugar is not good for us, and certainly high fructose corn syrup is not good for us. But the artificial sweeteners like aspartame are way worse than that. And when they did this study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition in February of 2013, they said that people who consumed 12 ounces of diet soda a week, okay, it's not a day,
a
week.
So that's not really very much.
Not very much. Increase their risk of diabetes by 33%. And those people that took in 20 ounces a week or more had an increased risk of 66%. And that's mostly from aspartame. So we're looking at something here that is very impressive. And, you know, we reviewed this topic some time ago as related to artificial sweeteners and the risk of heart attacks. And it was clearly much higher in people who are having artificial sweeteners. So It's something to take home.
This is another brainwashing thing.
Exactly.
You know, people have been brainwashed to think, well, if there's no calories.
Mm-hmm. So how could it be a problem?
Yeah, that it can't be a problem.
Well, here's how it can be a problem. If you take in artificially sweetened whatever, what happens is your brain still gets the message that something sweet is coming along. That's called the cephalic part of digestion, which is where your body is responding to the smell and to the taste.
An association.
Well, it affects.
Psychological aspects, placebo effect.
Well, yeah, but they have powerful biochemical and physiological effects. Okay, and that's the point I want to make now. So what happens is when we take in this aspartame, our pancreas gets the message sweets are coming along, so it produces more insulin. And as it produces more insulin, it drops our blood sugar. And what does that do? It makes you hungry because your appetite center registers to low blood sugar. So you then go eat, and the problem is you actually eat more that way, and this study supports that. So we've been saying this for years. It's good to see a study that came out and finally said it.
So then what about also the artificial flavors? What effect do those have?
Well, the same thing. It would do the same kind of problem. That's right. So when we're talking about women that are on diet drinks, they actually consume more in the way of diet drinks in volume than people that are drinking regular sodas.
But see, too, if they're artificially flavored, people drink twice as many of them as compared to the ones that
drink. Right, that's what I'm just saying. That's a good point. And so the question is are these people inherently different in what their appetite is like? And I think there is a difference there. I mean, people who are really after or really addicted or have a need for some biochemical or physiological reason to consume more food, they will drink more of the diet drink itself, not realizing that that's going to eventually come back and haunt them, as we've been talking about.
So how does this compare to drinking fruit juice?
Same thing. From the point of regular sodas that are sugar filled with sugar, but the artificial sweetened drinks are much worse than the fruit juices, particularly the ones that are fresh squeezed, which I'd say a small amount is fine every day.
So this is really interesting, isn't it, that these drinks can increase the risk of diabetes, and yet the American Dietetic Association, and what about the Diabetic Association?
Yeah, that's what I said earlier.
Both of them, they're recommending diet drinks.
Yeah, so the same thing with most doctors. I mean, it really amazes me to walk into the doctor's lounge, and what do you see? You see both diet drinks and regular, things like Coca-Cola and Pepsi all over the place. And what else is there?
Really? In the doctor's waiting room?
The doctor's lounges.
Oh, okay,
when they go to the hospital.
Oh,
when you go to that lounge and see what they eat.
Oh.
And of course, doctors are as overweight as anybody else. I mean, they're not exactly setting the kind of example that you and they don't believe, or else they wouldn't do that. And it's by popular demand. You know, they've got the donuts and the trans fats, and I think they're starting to wake up to some extent. But the last time I was in the hospital, I was very impressed with what, you know, the hospital tends to give doctors a lot of little perks, like free lunches, and they'll give them snacks
free,
that they
free
can
Free Diet Coke.
Diet Cokes are all over the place, and they're drinking them up like that. We don't have anything to worry about here. This is totally safe.
Well, too, I think to keep in mind that 25.8 million children and adults in the United States have diabetes, and it's a leading cause of blindness, and it can also cause heart disease, stroke, high blood pressure, kidney disease, damage to the nervous system. And to think that type 2 diabetes can be controlled by diet and exercise is just amazing.
Well, this is a disease that is made by modern living if you don't live a healthy lifestyle. If you just exercise regularly and you eat a healthy diet that's low in carbohydrates and certainly low in artificial sweeteners, you're going to do a heck of a lot better. And this is a reversible disease nearly always. I mean, there's a very low percentage of people that it's not.
I think a lot of people are addicted to these artificial sweeteners.
No question.
And so you need to try to figure out a substitute.
Well, the addiction's real, too. And we did a report on this about 8 or 10 years ago, and it's on the site someplace, that talks about how people can actually be addicted and have withdrawal symptoms from being on artificial sweeteners. So it's not a small
thing. Well,
you maybe
could just try some plain sparkly water and add a little fruit juice to it and see if you can acquire a taste for doing that.
Well, it works pretty well for me. I know I'll do that. I particularly like grapefruit juice, so I'll use a little bit of that. But I like also lemon and lime, and just chill the water, and
some
I like a lot.
Some people like something sweeter, though. So
well, that's,
there's sweeter juices.
We're all different.
Put a dash of it.
It's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health radio, and we'll be talking about, can omega-3 fatty acids protect against breast cancer? So stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
A Canadian study just revealed some exciting news in preventing and inhibiting the growth of breast cancer. So tell us about this significant and unequivocal finding in reducing the risk of cancer.
You know, the way you said that was really powerful, unequivocal, because, you know, we've had epidemiological studies that have suggested this for years, but in general, unless it's a double-blinded, crossed-over, placebo, and blinded study, nobody pays attention to it. But in this particular case, it is unequivocal because of the way they did the study. This was published in the Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry in February of 2013, and they looked at transgenic mice that had a high incidence of breast cancer and also had the ability to make omega-3s that normally we can't make. So what we have here is a mouse that has a very high risk for developing breast cancer that also can make omega-3 essential fatty acids, something that we don't see in nature. And what they did then was track these mice over time, over their lifespan, which is not that long. It's weeks to months. And what they did find is that when they had the ability to have high levels of omega-3 fatty acids for their lifetime, that there was a 30% less risk for developing cancer. And the tumors also were about 30% smaller. So this is a big revelation, even though this is not in human beings.
And it's not a drug, and it doesn't have bad side effects. It's
right.
Only good that can come from fish oil.
Well,
it's important, though,
yes.
I think, when you take fish oil, to make sure you get a purified form that doesn't have mercury in it.
Yeah, and I think most of them are like that now. Now, when we're looking at this particular thing, the omega-3s, of course, and are not something that human beings can make, and we're not suggesting that we should do any genetic modification so we can.
No.
We're basically just saying consume omega-3 fatty acids and healthy omega-6s because they're really important for our health. Now that we have this very solid evidence that doesn't depend on an epidemiological study, it's a lot more comforting to know that if we consume more essential fatty acids, that the chances are we're going to be healthier, not just from the point of view of cancers, but a lot of other things that we've known about for years.
Well, there's other benefits to fish oil, too, besides
sure.
preventing breast cancer.
For
it
sure.
also is an anticoagulant. It
uh-huh.
works as an antiarrhythmic.
Yep.
It's just healthy for cell membranes. It waterproofs our skin. It makes up our brain and our hearts.
Yeah, the list goes on and on. It's good stuff. And the omega-6s are important as well. You know, we're always talking about, oh, don't eat too many omega-6s because the omega-6 to 3 ratio, if it's off, you're going to have a problem with your health. That's bunk. The problem is this. The omegas, we need both of these essential fatty acids that we cannot make that do all these good things Vicki's talking about, plus a lot more. And that's important. So we need to know that we need those. But the problem is the omega-6s that we're eating are refined and they're processed. And by the time we get them, they're not healthy anymore. But if we had cold-pressed good vegetable oils, very healthy for us.
Well, let's talk a little bit about flaxseed oil, because back in 2007, the NIH knew then that flaxseed oil could reduce the risk of prostate cancer. And it seems to me that it's been pretty much ignored. But, you know, flaxseed oil, particularly the high lignin flaxseed oil, mm-hmm. because the lignin is the stuff that helps to prevent cancer, is so important. So a person that can't take the fish oil for some reason, they might want to take the flaxseed oil instead, huh?
Well, it works pretty good. And here's the thing. You know, the University of Michigan did a study published in 2007, and it was the lead article for the ASCO conference, the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And the thing was, and it was probably their biggest finding for the year, and that was that flaxseed oil protected against the growth and spread of prostate cancer. That's a big finding. Now, if you go through the people, the oncologists, the urologists who treat people with prostate cancer, how often do you see them using essential fatty acids? Hardly ever. And why? Because our brain has been trained and ingrained so much to believe in drugs and surgeries and technologies that this just passes us by. And it's a great opportunity to add to whatever else we're doing because it does these wonderful things.
Is it okay to take fish oil and flaxseed oil, or is that too much?
Well, it's interesting because, see, flaxseed oil has two main ingredients in it. One is alpha-linolenic acid, and that makes the omega-3 side. That makes the omega-3 essential fatty acids, but our body has to process them. It needs enzymes to be able to convert the alpha-linolenic acid into EPA and DHA. And if it can't do that, then you don't get it. And a lot of people who are sick cannot do that. And you don't know who can and who can't unless you measure to see what the levels of EPA, DHA, and other essential fatty acids in the omega-3 side are like.
So people that are sick, it's probably better to just take fish oil.
Yes, but now there's another half to the story. There's an omega-6 side as well. Fish oil doesn't have omega-6 in it. It has only omega-3. So if you take flaxseed oil, you've got the alpha-linolenic acid we've been talking about that does a nice job of making the omega-3s, but it also has linoleic acid, which is converted into the active ingredients in the omega-6 side, and those include things like GLA, which is gamma-linolenic acid, arachidonic acid, and many others that are converted to a lot of interesting compounds that manage inflammation.
Don't you get omega-6s in other seeds and nuts as well?
Yes, you do. The seeds and nuts in general do. But fish oil, see, is uniquely primarily omega-3.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference between those two. So in my patients who are not healthy and they need essential fatty acids particularly, I'll give them fish oil, and then I'll give them the breakdown products of the omega-6 side. So I'll often give them evening primrose oil or black currant oil.
Oh.
Or what are the other oils that is important?
Borage.
Borage oil, yes, that's the one, that makes the GLA, the gamma-linolenic acid, that's converted into down-chain metabolites further to regulate inflammation in the body. It's a really interesting, complicated biochemistry that I think I just simplified for you. I hope so.
Who would you recommend take fish oil and flaxseed oil, and how much would you recommend?
Well, it depends on what you're taking it for. I mean, if you're taking it for depression, for example, probably about 9 grams of fish oil a day, a high-quality fish oil, would be a good thing to do because it seems to help to reduce depression. If you're trying to manage anticoagulation, fish oil, the EPA in it is what has the anticoagulant effect that works like aspirin does or like Plavix does. They're antiplatelet agents. You give a varied dose depending on how much anticoagulation you need. And the way I determine that is by doing a live blood cell analysis where I can see blood in the dark field microscope and see if the red cells are clumping, and if the platelets are clumping, and if you've got lots of fibrin and clot in there, you can see it. And then we do what's called a live blood cell analysis challenge test. Then we add a certain amount of fish oil or some other anticoagulant like natokinase or lumbrokinase or ginkgo and see what it does. So we titrate
that. So then you do the test again and see.
Exactly.
What, an hour later or something?
Yeah. Now, see, we don't do that in the mainstream of medicine. We just give the aspirin or we give the Coumadin or we give the Pradaxa or all these new things that are out there that are drugs looking for something to do with.
Okay, so would you recommend a person take fish oil and flaxseed oil?
Not generally. I think we get enough omega-6s usually in our diet just by eating vegetables.
So it's better if you do it to just do one or the other. I've heard you say before that everybody should have flaxseed oil every day.
Well, flaxseed oil for young people, especially people that are well, is a great thing to do. And I like the Barlean's company because we went up there and we visited with them and we work with them. And it was really good to – they're honest, good people that make a good product. Anyway, that's how this goes. Anyway, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on deaths from medication overdoses are on the rise. And when we come back, we'll be talking about can epidural steroid injections make you worse in the long term? And how can we improve nutrition in our school lunches? Stay tuned.
As a reminder, 2,976 people died on 9/11. 2,500,000 people died in wars justified by 9/11.
Wow, those are sobering numbers.
And since 9/11, more than 4 million have died from drugs and more than 10 million have died from medical care.
Wow, that's stunning, isn't it?
Yeah, that's something to think about. You know, with drug overdose deaths on the rise, the experts are pushing to recognize the signs of addiction. And the Journal of the American Medical Association shows that drug overdose deaths are on the rise for the 11th straight year, and 60% are due to medications, and the majority are from prescription drugs. And OxyContin and Vicodin are the most frequently involved, accounting for 3 out of 4 medication overdose deaths, and only 17% of the deaths were suicides, meaning that the vast majority were unintentional overdoses. So this is really a big problem, and it's gotten a lot worse. So we need to think about what to do about it. And the first step is recognizing or helping people recognize that they need help. And some of the signs include seeing behavioral changes that seem to be kind of out of the ordinary, maybe mood swings or altered sleep habits, some sort of bizarre behavior, maybe even like lying and stealing and changes in their friends and unexpected weight loss, things like this. And coworkers could notice maybe if the people were less reliable or they're coming to work later, they're missing deadlines, they're isolating themselves in their offices, maybe having more unexcused absences. And then maybe having financial problems and medical visits for panic attacks or chest palpitations. More adults are on prescription drugs and giving children access to them. And a lot of the young people have this easier access to prescription pills just from their parents' medicine cabinet. So this is something to think about. This can start even in middle school. A parent might notice that they don't have quite as many pills in the bottle, but they don't kind of get the idea that their kid's stealing from them because they don't even think about it. So these are things to be thinking about and to be aware of. Doctors seem to be prescribing them more freely. It seems that about 40 years ago, a lot of the doctors were holding off from giving out pain medications. Did you notice it used to be more difficult to get prescriptions? And for some reason, a lot of doctors now are giving them out easier, and they don't really realize how addictive that these addictive painkillers can be. So,
well, the doctors get caught between a rock and a hard place, Vicki, because in part, if they don't provide adequate pain relief for patients, they get into lots of trouble. And yet, if they give too many prescriptions, they're creating another problem that has to do with what you're talking about.
Yeah, so they're often given for conditions that could be managed with, you know, other ways. So this is...
I've seen doctors taken to their medical boards because they didn't give enough in the way of narcotics to patients that were suffering from pain. It's a catch-22 in a lot of ways. And it means you got to know your patient and know the situation pretty well.
Yeah. Well, anyway, on to our topics. We already reported on steroid injections slowing healing, and now a study shows that epidural spinal injections for spinal stenosis may actually lead to worse outcomes even with surgery. So I guess they're just a temporary fix for serious back pain, and yet this is a common treatment that's offered by orthopedists.
Well, it works in the short term, and for some people it's almost miraculous because they can have maybe one epidural injection a year or maybe two a year and then not have it for a few years, and then maybe it'll flare up again. And so they may get away without having surgery and do pretty well. But for most people over the long haul, over a four-year period, what they found was is with or without surgery, the outcomes were no better with epidural steroids, and it was a lot of the time a worse outcome. And that was published in the February 2013 issue of a journal called Spine. So we're looking at a problem here that's huge. And really, you know, we talked last week about tennis elbows and the problems that they had with injections. And that didn't show long-term benefit at the end of a year either. In fact, they did worse. And the reason that we gave for that is because steroids wonderfully deal with inflammation and they lower it tremendously. But there's a price you pay for it. And that price has to do with a lack of healing. In fact, it retards healing. So if you reduce inflammation but you slow down the healing process, you leave the area that you've treated with the injection vulnerable to have not healed fully because the steroids stop the healing process.
For a minute here, let's define what spinal stenosis is.
Yeah, that's a narrowing of the canal, the spinal canal, when you have a disc problem. Usually that happens in two areas, in the cervical spine and in the lumbar spine. This particular study was looking at lumbar spinal stenosis.
That's the lower part of the back.
Yeah. So when there's a disc that that ruptures, it encroaches on that space where those nerves are. And then it puts pressure on the nerves, and it's the pressure on the nerves that causes the symptoms. Often it leads to low back pain that may radiate down one leg or another and all the way into the foot, and that's, of course, called sciatica.
And when people are in this severe pain, they're willing to do almost anything to get relief.
It's miserable. It's a terrible thing.
So maybe we should talk about some of the alternatives to the epidural, since it really, in the long run, slows down the healing process.
Right. I think what you need is a doctor to take care of you, some kind of healthcare practitioner that has a broad range of areas of expertise. The integrative approach is what Vicki and I recommend, and that's what we practice, doing something called health medicine, which is about integrative medicine.
Yeah, you don't want to just jump right into getting back surgery.
No.
Unless it's an emergency, of course.
Well, even then, it's very rare that there's a true medical emergency.
What if somebody has a ruptured disc?
That's fine. You can have a ruptured disc. You will do just as well with chiropractic and body work and
really?
Physical therapy. Absolutely.
Because it'll heal on its own?
It'll heal on its own. Even if you have neurological defects, okay, with trouble with bladder control or you're incontinent of stool or you're having other problems that are substantial like loss of some muscle mass, you still may do better in the long haul, although most people would prefer surgery because, if things get worse, you're in deep pucky.
Yeah, well, that would cause enough for a panic attack.
Oh, for sure. So the other approaches we're talking about are things like chiropractic and acupuncture and physical therapy. Ultrasound
and the TENS unit, hypnosis and ice and heat, DMSO.
Qigong.
Stretches. And then, of course, the photon stimulator.
Well, yeah, that's the real key here. You know, we're always talking about the photon stimulator, and maybe a lot of you are wondering why we talk about it so much, but you know, I've been doing that for 14 years now, and I'm one of the only people in Northern California that does it properly using infrared scanning at the time that we're actually doing the treatment.
We want more people to learn how to do this.
It's the biggest change I've seen in medicine that's positive in the 45 years I've been in practice. It's an unbelievable technology that reduces pain, but it promotes healing, and that's the difference between the steroid injection and the light therapy. And the light works immediately, just like the epidural does. So it's really like doing an epidural injection with light, but instead of retarding healing, you're promoting healing.
Yeah, one of the other things to point out here, I think, is that people that have been getting the epidural injections with the steroids, it actually makes their surgeries more difficult, more complicated.
For sure. It makes them longer, and it means that about a half an hour longer, and it also means they stay in the hospital a day longer. And their complications are probably higher, too, although they didn't mention that in this particular study. To imagine they are.
They also said that there was no evidence that the steroid injections helped the person to avoid the surgery either.
Yeah, well, that's right. So,
but, you know, when you're really, really hurting.
Yeah, you know, you want something to fix it. But you have to use your common sense, too.
So it might be a good idea to try some of these alternatives that we were talking about first. And if that doesn't work, then maybe get one. And then if it's all over, then you're done, then you're okay. But if it still is a problem, I would suggest continuing some other alternatives. We just gave you a list of a lot of different ideas.
So what do we do in health medicine? We're integrative, holistic, person-centered, and preventive. Those are the four corners of what we use in that process. And the integrated part, and what we do at the Health Medicine Center in Walnut Creek, California, is we do a combination of acupuncture and chiropractic. We often use body work and hypnotherapy. And, of course, we focus hard on the photon stimulator, because most people who have that problem, who have a problem with back pain that's terrible, they want relief now. And this combination within 2 to 4 weeks really quiets it down, and most people are substantially improved.
So you would give a person, how long would you give a person to try alternatives before resorting to surgery if they continue to have their back pain?
Well, it depends on what they want. Some people are not going to do surgery no matter what, and I can't blame them, but at the same time, it should be a consideration because it does help some people. The problem with it is that if things go wrong, you're done. It's real hard to repair something when a surgery hasn't worked out right. And I don't mean it's necessarily botched.
You call that failed back syndrome?
Yes, that's a failed back syndrome. You know, I could tell you some stories about people like that. We had one person at age 28 have a ruptured disc. They went ahead and they trimmed the disc. Then they went in and they fused the disc. Then they went in and they put rods. And then they took the rods out. And he was on his way at age 32 to the University of California in San Francisco for a morphine pump. But he stopped to see us first on the way, okay, a few days before, because he'd heard about the light. Within 3 or 4 weeks, he was largely off all of his medicines. Today, 10 years later, he has no problem with back pain. He exercises at the gym. He plays golf. He's raising a family. He's got his life back. This integrative approach is just short of magic. It works so well. And I hate to be such a positive person about these particular technologies, but, you know.
Well, you're excited about it. You know it works, and you want other people to know.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we're doing a research study at University of California in San Francisco that's NIH-sponsored for $7 million on people who have neuropathies caused by chemotherapy. So this is not some figment of just my imagination. We've got a lot of people engaged in using this, and we're seeing many more articles coming out talking about this. So it is the medicine of the future for people who have pain, particularly back pain.
Okay. The United States Department of Agriculture passed regulations to make school lunches more nutritious, increasing whole grain and fruits and vegetables. And this new study determined that small, inexpensive changes to school cafeterias influenced children's choice and consumption of healthier food. So how did they implement this lunchroom makeover?
Well, these people were clever. This was a study that was published in the Journal of Pediatrics after the USDA came out with its new regulation saying what Vicki just said, which is they're requiring schools to have more whole grains and making students make a choice between either a fruit or a vegetable that's with every lunch that they buy. And that's a big thing that she pointed out. And what did it take, according to this study? It took no more than 3 hours to make over the setup that they had in the cafeteria and about $50 to implement. And if you want to see that, go to the February issue of the Journal of Pediatrics, and it's in there. And what they found is that kids took in 13% more fruits. They took in 23% more vegetables, and they were eating a more nutritious lunch.
Well, let's talk about what they did to encourage that. You know, they made the fruits and vegetables look more attractive the way that they, you know, laid them out. And they had some next to the cash register. You know, that's always a catch when you're standing at the cash register.
You're waiting. Yeah, you might notice it.
Yeah. And so they were just like trying to make the selection of the fruits and vegetables seem like a standard thing. And some of the cafeteria staff would say things to them like, would you like to try an apple today?
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know,
they hadn't thought about it really. But
it had influenced their choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's really good. And you have to really look at why do schools, hospitals, many government organizations skimp on food budgets? You'd think that especially hospitals would offer food that's healthy and nutritious. It would be organic and whole foods. And what you're still seeing is the same garbage that we're serving 15 years ago in a lot of hospitals. You look at the doctor's lounge where foods are, and it's a disgrace. I mean, there's tons of soft drinks and fruit drinks that are high in fructose, high fructose corn syrup.
It would be good if we could change this, not even just in hospitals, but also other companies and retirement homes. And
oh, for sure.
I'd love to see retirement homes put coconut oil in and cook with that, you know.
Big for people who have Alzheimer's disease to take about 6 tablespoons a day of coconut oil. It helps with the metabolism there. So we're looking at changes that need to be made so people can recover. I mean, you look at some of the things that have been reported in the literature. There was a study done by a fellow named Schoenthaler about 30 years ago where all he did was give one healthy lunch to students in high schools or to people in prisons, and they found that violence went down 44%.
And if you say that your kids don't like fruits and vegetables, you can sneak those vegetables into some of the sauces and things that you cook and into the soups, puree them, and that kind of thing.
And we have more to tell you, but we're at the end of the show, so we'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health every Monday morning on PRN.FM and drsabuto.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available on 24/7 on PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our fast-track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe, so if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
See you next time. Have a great week.